Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. Thank you so much for tuning into our fall season, and thank you for listening to all of our series and supporting us all these years. I want to ask that you please support our sponsors because our sponsors support us, and a big thank you to them. Without them, we couldn't continue to do the work to help the wrongfully convicted. The second thing I want to say before we dive into today's episode is this. Whether it's this case or any other case that we've worked on, we've actually got a tip line. So if anybody out there has some information they think could help us in our investigation into this case, the State versus Greg Lance, or any of the cases we've worked on, please give us a call. The tip line is 410-205-5563. Once again, the tip line is 410-205-5563. A quick correction before we begin. In last week's episode, we said Victor Kolesnikow had sold the Ford Mobile Home Park the year prior to being murdered. This was incorrect. He actually sold the park in 1996, 2 years prior to being killed, as this episode will explore. Long after dawn broke on the morning of August 5th, 1998, over a dozen first responders, arson investigators, and local and state law enforcement officers still milled around the Kolesnikow property. It was a good 6 or 7 hours since the house had been set on fire, sometime in the middle of the night. But the blaze had been so intense that the authorities were still waiting for the heat from it to subside before removing the bodies and investigating the scene. The Cookeville Herald Citizen ran the story in their morning edition, as the remains of the house were still smoldering and before the bodies had even been recovered. It read, "A house fire in the Poplar Grove community east of Cookeville early this morning, which claimed two lives and completely destroyed the house, is being investigated as arson-related homicide. Preceding the fire, which spread throughout the one-story ranch-style brick house, a loud explosion reportedly was heard by neighbors. Although authorities would not officially release the names of the victims, the house at 6525 Poplar Grove Road was the residence of Victor and Alla Kolesnikow," a family source told the Herald Citizen. At mid-morning, the bodies had not been removed while emergency service workers waited for the smoldering heat to subside. This was the article that Greg Lance read that morning, alerting him to the details of the crime, which he had already gotten wind of through a friend. Little did he know that by the next morning, the Herald Citizen would already be alluding to a suspect in the murders, and that suspect would be him. Welcome to Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan's Story. I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
We often get asked how we find the cases that we cover on Undisclosed. In most cases, people reach out to us. Lawyers, innocence projects, loved ones of a defendant, or sometimes the defendant themselves. Once in a while, though, we come across a case ourselves and become intrigued. That's what happened in this case. Every so often, I'll browse websites or Facebook pages where wrongful conviction cases are shared and detailed, often as pleas for fundraising or media attention or other kinds of help. And at some point last year, I came across a website, justiceforgreg.com. The crime was, to me, an uncommon case. There didn't seem to be a domestic or sexual assault component, it didn't involve a burglary gone wrong, and it certainly didn't seem like a crime of opportunity. This double murder of the Ukrainian couple out in the middle of nowhere was targeted and planned. Was it a personal vendetta, a political hit? I really wanted to find out more. When I reached out to the administrator of the website, I heard back from two women, Joyce Argo and Linda Bausman. Joyce is Greg's mother, and she's his fiercest advocate. She's really the only person who was there at the beginning of this ordeal and is still there, doing everything in her power to get justice for her son. Linda, however, has no relation to Greg at all.
My name is Linda Bausman. I'm currently retired. I worked in the court system for 35 years. I've been involved with the Greg Lance case for the last 18 years.
A chance conversation in the grocery store Publix, of all places, happened between Greg's stepfather and Linda Bausman not long after Greg was convicted. Back then, in 2001, Linda was working two jobs trying to support her two children as a single mother.
I worked for a judge in Martin County in the circuit court for 2 years until she was appointed by the governor to the appellate court in West Palm Beach in Florida, and I worked for her 28 years there. I edited opinions, you know, the typical things that judicial assistants do, make flight reservations, travel vouchers, you know, edit memos of the law clerks. I became involved in 2001. I was working two jobs at the time. I worked at Publix part-time and worked down at the court full-time. I was a single mom raising two boys, and I needed the extra income, and Greg's stepfather, Jim Tucker, was in the store and began speaking to me about Greg's case and all of the problems there in Putnam County and everything that had happened there.
Jim returned to the store another time with Greg's mother, Joyce, who asked Linda to come over to her home so she could tell her about her son. And from what I've learned, Joyce never misses an opportunity to talk about Greg. It's worked more than once to convince people to help with the case.
After having worked for the state of Florida in the criminal side of things for, you know, 35 years, you're always skeptical about a mom who says that someone is innocent because it is their child. But the more I got into the details of the case, the more a lot of it didn't make sense.
Linda started off cautiously, trying to get a sense of the facts and also Greg himself.
I went up to listen to the oral argument in Nashville with them. And at that time, I told Joyce that I had, before I got any more involved in the case, that I was going to have to go to the prison and meet Greg because I needed to see for myself that he was not someone who was just trying to snowball everyone and, you know, make sure that in my heart that I knew he was innocent. I had to know that. The meeting was fine. We were there quite a while. I suppose we got there at 9 in the morning or something and stayed until 3 or so. I couldn't imagine after meeting Greg that he could have done something like this. I just didn't see it in his nature. But even after that, there's still a lot of questions in my mind, you know, that as time went on, as you know, new questions come up and other things. So it's been a process over the years, sorting through it all and just to make sure that I had made the right decision by becoming involved at all.
I know what Linda means. With every case we consider for undisclosed, the process is similar. We don't know until we are pretty sure we know that we have the case of an innocent person on our hands. Susan, would you believe that I have been using VistaPrint for, I don't know, I think like 15 years?
That's a long time.
It's a long time, yeah, because I started using them when we had internet and I ordered these things online almost 15 years ago because I had started my own little practice as a solo practitioner and I needed to find something that was affordable. I needed to find an affordable way to make business cards, signs, brochures, flyers, all kinds of things to try and get clients. In fact, we use VistaPrint for our podcast, don't we?
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't been using it for 14 years, but I've been using it for 4 years now.
We've got all our podcast cards from VistaPrint. What else have we gotten from them? Banners, we've gotten goodies to give out. We love them.
So if you're ready to get started on your own business cards, it's easy. Just plug in your information and logo into hundreds of fresh designs tailored to your type of company, or upload your own original layout. Then pick the paper stock, style, and quantity that's right for you. And you can even upgrade with the unique touches like rounded corners. Then order and receive your cards with free economy shipping.
Yeah, I'm no designer, so I always use their amazing, beautiful, ready-made designs, and it takes me like 10 minutes to create whatever I need to create on Vistaprint. So look, Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get free shipping on all business cards, any style, any quantity. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter the promo code UNDISCLOSED2, the number 2, for free shipping on all business cards, any style, any quantity. It's a limited time offer. Own the now at Vistaprint.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED2. That's promo code UNDISCLOSED followed by the number 2. And remember, you support our show when you support our sponsors.
In 1998, Greg Lantz was an ambitious 27-year-old real estate developer and contractor for both residential and commercial buildings. A Cookeville native, Greg had attended Motlow State Community College, majoring in secondary education and minoring in political science. He'd been an achiever throughout school, participating in student government, vocational clubs, and winning awards as part of the Future Farmers of America. In his junior year of high school, he enlisted in the National Guard, and a few years later graduated with honors, second in his class, in advanced individual training, getting a perfect score on physical fitness, and achieving the level of expert in marksmanship in individual and crew-serve weapons. He had a knack for construction and a drive to build a secure financial future. So after teaching for a couple of years and not making much money, he went into contracting and real estate development full-time. Now, this sounds more glamorous than it was, but essentially, he had bought a few acres with some trailers on it, and also a 17-unit apartment building, which he owned jointly with his first wife, Elizabeth McAllister. They were collecting rent from the units, and Greg was taking on construction jobs, but he was on the lookout for a new investment with a bigger return. So one day in early 1996, Greg and Elizabeth got in their pickup truck and drove around Putnam County until they reached the Ford Mobile Home Park on the outskirts of Cookeville.
We were looking for some rental property to buy. And we literally just drove around and would stop and ask people if they wanted to sell their place. And we first stopped at the Cookeville Mobile Home Park and talked to them. And they gave us a price that was, you know, they were interested in selling. But the price they gave us was, a whole lot more for a whole lot less. They only had 5 acres, and they wanted like $600,000 for 5 acres. The second place we stopped at was Victor's Mobile Home Park. And him and Ola were just out in their yard. Doing something or another. We stopped, talked to them, and asked them if they were interested in selling, and Victor said no, and he explained all of what was we were talking about, and she's like, oh no, we're selling it. Yeah, absolutely. stay and talk to us.
In case it wasn't clear, that was Greg Lantz. Throughout the season, you'll be hearing from him from time to time. Anyhow, at the time that Greg met them, the Klisnick House had owned the trailer park for about 4 or 5 years, but it was no easy task for an older couple to keep up the maintenance for all the units, as well as to keep the property up to code, which is why Ala wanted to be rid of it. Greg was handy, hardworking, and enterprising, and wasn't shy about why he was there. Greg could see the potential in the trailer park. He had the skills to renovate and clean up the trailers, and generate more rent than they were currently bringing in. But Elizabeth made it clear that she felt Greg was getting in over his head, and she wasn't ready to make this tremendous financial commitment, signing her name to a $650,000 mortgage, the price that Victor was ready to sell the property at. At that time, Elizabeth and Greg had been married for about 4 years, since 1992. Their relationship had proved to be a volatile one, and during the course of their marriage, they experienced the loss of a child that lived only a few hours. Both Elizabeth and Greg alleged physical abuse at the hands of the other, but neither ever pressed charges against the other.
Today, when I asked each one of them why they divorced, they gave different answers. Elizabeth said she simply wasn't on board with Greg's ambitions and refused to sign the mortgage, so Greg decided to divorce her. But Greg says that he had had enough of being abused by Elizabeth, and after the last time she assaulted him, he immediately went to see his attorney and began divorce proceedings. Whichever it was, the actual divorce decree states irreconcilable differences. The two divorced in April of 1996, and Greg closed on the 12-acre Ford Mobile Home Park on October 21st, 1996, for $650,000 with both bank and owner financing.
Right, borrowed $280,000 from the bank or around there, and then Victor held a mortgage, a second mortgage for the balance for a total of $650,000.
Greg secured the loans with the properties that he already owned, the apartment building and the 2.5-acre plot of land with a few mobile homes on it. A month before closing, Greg moved into a trailer in the park while Victor and Alla continued to live in the main brick house. They eventually moved into the home on Poplar Grove Road, about 20 minutes away, and Greg moved into the house. He then spent the next 2 years not just cleaning and repairing the park, but expanding his contracting business under the Gestoria Construction Company banner. In August of 98, he was working on numerous large projects and had spent the day before the murders putting up trusses on a commercial property in Livingston, Tennessee, about 20 miles away, working for a Mr. Ed Dixon.
I spoke to Mr. Dixon, and he still recalls Greg working on that project for him. He actually hadn't known him until he hired him for it, but he was pretty impressed with the young man's discipline. From what he recalled, Greg, unlike other contractors he had experience with, always showed up when he said he would and completed the work as he said he would. But the crew that he brought with him was another story. Dixon didn't like them one bit. He found something about them shady. But he trusted Greg and trusted him to use his own very expensive equipment, like his crane. And the job was eventually finished up just fine. Greg had numerous business partners on his different ventures, and his minority partner and manager of the mobile home park was a friend by the name of Keith Herbstreit.
I paid Keith $1,000 cash money, plus he got 10% of the profit. A lot of months we didn't make profit because I would just put the money back into fixing it up.
Mm-hmm.
Given this arrangement, Greg considered him an unofficial partner. Around 8 a.m. on the morning of August 5th, 1998, Keith got a call from David Daniels, the city code's enforcement officer. It was Daniels' job to conduct safety inspections at all the mobile home parks, so he was well acquainted with the Kalisnik House, Greg Lance, and the Ford Mobile Home Park. According to the statement that Daniels gave to the police, Keith had called Daniels the day prior to the murders, requesting that he stop by to do an inspection that week. But the next morning, a coworker told him about the fire at the Kalisnika House. He knew this news would be of definite interest to Keith and Greg. In his police statement, Daniel says that from what he had heard, early reports about the fire made it sound like a propane tank had exploded in the house, a tragic accident that left the couple dead, which is what he told Keith that morning. Keith told him he hadn't heard anything about it. What a shame. And the two men hung up. Keith was one of a few of Greg's employees who actually lived with him in the brick house that stood in the trailer park. Kay lived in a trailer park about 20 minutes away from the Ford Mobile Home Park, so after Keith hung up with the city inspector, he hustled over to see Greg and tell him about the fire. A couple of hours later, David Daniels stopped by the mobile home park and saw Greg and Keith in the driveway to Greg's house. Greg's girlfriend Becky Pollard and Keith's girlfriend Kay were also there when Daniels showed up. According to his statement, Daniels asked the men how they were doing, and more importantly, they had their ducks in a row. Now, it's not clear if he was implying that Greg could be in any type of criminal trouble. After all, by his own admission, at this point he still thought the fire was an accident. But he did know, like half the town, that Greg and Victor were in the middle of a foreclosure dispute. Victor was trying to take the Ford Mobile Home Park back from him. Around the same time that Daniels was over at Greg's place warning him, investigators were interviewing Lily Kalisnikow, Victor's sister. Part of the handwritten report of the interview, taken at 10:50 a.m., read,
"A problem developed between the new owner of the mobile home park and Victor. Victor was in the process to get the mobile home park back. Lily does not know anything about the owner of the Ford Mobile Home Park."
On April 8, 1998, 4 months before they were murdered, the Kalisnik House sent Greg Lance a letter about their secured debt in the Ford Mobile Home Park. It was a notice to Greg that as the lawful owners of the mortgage note, they were foreclosing on the property. It was their option upon him defaulting that they could demand acceleration of payment of the entire $370,000 debt plus interest, attorney's fees, and other costs within 15 days.
The letter specified Greg's default as the following, quote, "The indebtedness due is in default due to non-payment of property taxes for the year 1997, failure to maintain the whole of the property in ready-to-rent condition, failure to expand the mobile home park as agreed in the contract, and failure to assign the security set forth in enumerated paragraphs of the contract for the purchase and sale of real estate dated October 21st, 1996.
He was trying to say that I had agreed to build X amount of mini storage units in the mobile home park, and that I hadn't done that, that I built 10 of them and stopped because there wasn't that much of a demand for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to build more. I just didn't have the money to do it all at once like that. No, I was caught up on my payments. I wasn't behind at the time that he started foreclosure. The only thing that I hadn't paid yet was the taxes.
The fact that he hadn't yet paid the previous year's property taxes and had failed to fulfill a contract condition that called for him to install a certain number of storage units on the property were convenient excuses to take the property back, unless Greg could cough up $370,000 in 15 days. Greg was convinced that Victor wanted the property back because the improvements he'd made to it had increased the value. Whatever the reason, it was, of course, an impossibility for Greg to pay back the entire note within 15 days. So on May 1st, the Klesnikows initiated the foreclosure and set a sale of the property for 10 a.m. May 25th, offering the Ford Mobile Home Park for sale to, quote, the highest bidder for cash and free from all legal, equitable, and statutory rights for redemption. Greg, however, was prepared. In fact, he'd sort of anticipated this move by Victor, because it wouldn't have been the first time that he'd attempted to foreclose on property he'd sold over nitpicky claims.
I knew I could do it. I thought, before I ever even bought the property, I talked to an attorney.
Okay.
You know, because I had everybody was, you know, saying that Victor was a shark, and, you know, his M.O. was that he would sell people property, you know, on owner financing, and then, you know, let them pay a bunch of money into it and then foreclose on them.
It was common knowledge that Victor had a pattern of selling property with owner financing of joint notes and then finding a way to claim default after the buyer had made payments for years and even made improvements on the property, and then commencing foreclosure proceedings to take the property back. On the day of the murders, Lily Klesnikow, Victor's sister, even mentioned this modus operandi to the police. The handwritten report of her interview reads, quote, "Business dealings, Victor. He bought real estate, subdivided, placed older mobile homes on the property. He had a rent-to-own plan. Individuals that could not make their monthly payments would have their property repossessed."
And remember Captain Bob Lane from the Putnam County Fire Department from the first episode? Well, he mentioned that he knew Victor, and when I asked him how, it was related directly to this very pattern.
You said you knew the Klesnikows. You knew Victor?
I didn't know him very well. I'd had dealings with him as electrical inspector. He actually used me to evict somebody, and I wasn't very happy about it. He sort of tricked me, and I never would help him on nothing else. He owned properties in different places, and he sold a lot of people properties with land contracts, and then they get behind, he'd seize their property and get it back, and that kind of stuff. And he used me to evict a guy down in the 8th District. I didn't know the guy, but he used me to evict that guy with my power as electrical inspector.
Oh, wow. And you had no idea what was happening?
Well, I didn't really realize what he was doing until I got so deep in it I couldn't really stop. And then I realized what he was doing. Then I said, well, you got to fix it. Even if you make this guy move out, you've got to fix it. You know, he can't get it turned back on. I made him fix it.
Mm.
But that was the only dealings I'd really had with him, and they were brief,
yeah.
You know. And
you mentioned, and I've actually heard this from a couple other folks too, that this was something he seemed to do, where he would sell property, maybe owner finance, and then find an excuse to evict or foreclose.
Yeah.
So, Rabia, I've got some awesome new deodorant.
Just a very casual conversation between friends.
Yes.
I think I know all about your deodorant because I think I've got the same awesome new deodorant.
Yeah, we're talking about Native because it is the best deodorant I've ever used.
What I love about Native is it's formulated without aluminum, parabens, talc. It's got great natural like ingredients that you find in nature, like coconut oil, which is antimicrobial, by the way, shea butter, tapioca starch. And also, by the way, Susan, I didn't just get it for me. I got Native for my preteen because, you know, it's around that age when they start needing eating it, but I want to get them something that's not going to harm their bodies.
And NADA proves that making the switch to natural deodorant does not mean having to sacrifice on odor and wetness protection. And we're not the only ones who love Native. They have over 8,000 five-star reviews.
Native also comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for both men and women, plus they release new limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. And if you don't want any scents, well, they have an unscented formula and a baking soda free formula for those with sensitivities.
My favorite is the most popular, coconut and vanilla, but they have lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint. So for 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code undisclosed during checkout. Remember, for 20% off your first order, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code undisclosed during checkout.
We ran a check to see how many times Victor and Ala had attempted to foreclose on a property and evict the other party from it, but the Chancery Court in Putnam County only had digitized records going back to 1995. The Klusnikows had been buying, selling, and renting properties for at least 5 years before that, but just between the years of 1995 and 1998, they had commenced 25 different foreclosure actions, not even counting the one they filed against Greg Lance. So yeah, this wasn't their first rodeo. But Greg also wasn't their average mark. He was lawyered up, and he knew he had some legal recourse. 3 days before the foreclosure sale could take place, on May 22nd, the last business day before the sale, Greg filed a Chapter 11 bankruptcy petition, which triggered an automatic stay to the foreclosure proceedings. Now, it's important to understand the difference between different types of bankruptcy proceedings to get a clear picture of what was actually going on. There are a variety of different kinds of bankruptcy filings a debtor can make in federal bankruptcy court, and they aren't all created equal. Most people think a debtor files bankruptcy to wipe their debts clean and not have to repay them, but a number of bankruptcy filings actually don't absolve the debtor from paying off their debts. A Chapter 7 bankruptcy is the kind that most people are familiar with. It involves a trustee liquidating the debtor's assets and then using the proceeds to pay creditors whatever they're owed. Some types of debts can be discharged, meaning the debtor doesn't have to repay them, but others can't be, including liens on properties. Now, a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is an entirely different creature. It's not a liquidation proceeding. Rather, it's a reorganization proceeding. Chapter 11 is available to debtors trying to keep their property by reorganizing the debt and proposing a repayment plan to creditors. Generally speaking, the debtor has 4 months after filing to submit a reorganization plan, but can get an extension for over a year. And during this time, that person is considered a debtor in possession. That means they're still allowed to possess the business property and they're allowed to continue to operate it. And that's exactly what Greg planned to do. Keep running the mobile home park, making good on the deficiencies, reorganizing the debt, and ultimately keeping his property. As of his May 22nd filing, he had until September 23rd to file his reorganization plan, or even longer if he got an extension. But the Klusnikows were now forced to halt their foreclosure proceedings until and unless the bankruptcy court ordered otherwise, and they were prepared to fight.
The Klusnikows hired attorney Bradley McLean to represent them in the bankruptcy proceedings. And after their murder, he drafted a statement for TBI agent Bob Krofsik. In that statement, he laid out the chronology of events related to the foreclosure and bankruptcy, and he noted the following. After the bankruptcy was filed, Mr. Land ceased making monthly payments to either the bank or the Klusnikows. The Klusnikows were concerned about the deteriorating condition of the property, the non-payment of real estate taxes, and the non-payment of the monthly note amounts to either the bank or them. They filed a motion for relief from automatic stay with the bankruptcy court based upon these allegations, a motion that secured creditors can file so they can proceed with the foreclosure. The motion was filed on June 3rd, 1998, though, just 12 days after Greg filed for Chapter 11. As most property owners are aware, mortgage payments are generally due within the first 5 days at the beginning of the month, which would have been June 5th. So Greg didn't even get those 5 days to pay the mortgage before the Klusnikows filed their motion, alleging that he had failed to make the monthly payment. Beyond that, once the Chapter 11 petition was filed, Greg actually had no legal obligation to make any payments until this debt was reorganized by the court. Regardless, the bankruptcy court now had to rule on the Klusnikow motion, and a hearing was scheduled for July 7th, 1998 in Nashville. But before that hearing could take place, both Greg and the Kolesnikow's attorney negotiated an agreed order between the parties. Under the terms of the agreement, Greg would continue to make monthly payments to the bank and to the Kolesnikows. Both attorneys signed the order and sent it to the bankruptcy court a day before the hearing. But then that evening, after the order had been filed with the court, the Kolesnikows changed their minds and told their attorney they no longer agreed to it. They wanted to proceed with the hearing on the motion so they could get the foreclosure moving again. The hearing was rescheduled for July 14th, and attorney Bradley McLean brought two issues to the notice of the court. First, whether or not Greg was adequately protecting the interests of the Kolesnikows and the property. In other words, was he maintaining and improving it and not running it into the ground? And if he wasn't, whether the automatic stay could be lifted. And second, whether the Kolesnikows not only owed a lien on the property, but also on the rents collected, which he argued was cash collateral that secured the Kolesnikows' claim. McLean thought that Greg may have been using the rents collected to cover expenses without the court or Kolesnikow's permission, which was a violation of the bankruptcy code, so they filed a motion to prohibit Greg's use of cash collateral. Greg countered with his own motion, requesting the court to allow him to use the cash collateral to continue to run his business operations, and as a show of adequate protection, offered to continue making payments to the bank and the Kolesnikows, as their original agreed order had stated, make immediate payment on taxes owned. Along with the motion, he submitted budget and income statements with operating expenses, stating, quote, in order to remain in possession of its property and continue its business and attempt a successful reorganization, debtor must be permitted to use cash collateral in its ordinary business operations. Greg challenged the allegation the property had depreciated, stating the property value was currently at least $662,000, having appreciated since its purchase thanks to his improvements.
A hearing was set for July 28th to hear all the matters raised in these motions, but ended up continued again to a future date. In the meantime, negotiations were ongoing. On July 20th, McLean deposed Greg Lance, who brought Keith with him. McLean wrote in a statement that it seemed to him that Greg, quote, did not keep adequate accounting records of the business at the park, and that he did not have direct knowledge of many of the matters I was inquiring into. During the deposition, Greg repeatedly needed Keith's assistance in order to answer questions about the accounting. At the deposition, Greg twice offered to convey the property back to the Kolesnikows for a cash payment of $100,000 and the release of his debt, an offer they rejected both times. According to Greg, though, they did counter with an offer of $50,000 in cash, which Greg rejected. After all, the property was worth $662,000, and he currently only owed $589,000 on it. He figured that he and the Kolesnikows would eventually settle somewhere between the $50,000 and $100,000 figures that, by all indications, the parties were still open to negotiating. 2 days later, on July 22nd, McLean sent Greg's attorney another offer of settlement to buy back the property for what they had sold it for at $650,000 minus the property debts and attorney's fees. A week after that, on July 31st, another settlement offer was made by the Kolesnikows, agreeing to allow Greg to continue using the cash collateral. It seemed that both parties were inching towards an agreement as the final hearing date approached on August 7th, and both sides were preparing for the hearing. The case file shows that Greg prepared by submitting operating reports for June and July and renewed all the required insurance on the property. The Kolesnikows needed to inspect the property and line up witnesses for evidence of their claim that the trailer park was now worth less than what was owed on it, thanks to Greg's neglect. The weekend before the hearing, they were supposed to be gathering this evidence and preparing a spreadsheet to compare the income and expenses of the mobile home park when they owned and operated it versus when Greg took over. Whether or not they prepared it, McLean never got that spreadsheet because 2 days before the hearing, his clients were murdered. The investigators in the case asked McLean to provide a statement to address what he thought the chances were of the Kolesnikows winning at the hearing. This was his response.
It is difficult to assess the likelihood that the Kolesnikows would have prevailed at the hearing. Stay relief and cash collateral hearings are common occurrences in Chapter 11 bankruptcy cases. Ordinarily, early in the case, the bankruptcy court will not grant a secured creditor this kind of relief. In the usual case, the most likely result at this stage would be a bankruptcy court order denying the request for stay relief, but restricting the debtor's use of cash collateral to an approved budget. The court also often will set a deadline for the debtor to file and confirm a plan of reorganization. In these kinds of situations, it often happens that the debtor fails to meet the requirements of such an order, and the secured creditor ultimately obtains the right to foreclose.
McLean also testified at trial. There, he repeated that it was unlikely a creditor would be granted relief from a stay that early in the bankruptcy process. In other words, it was not likely the Klisnikows would have gotten the court to allow them to foreclose at that point. McLean also confirmed that Greg was current in his mortgage payments when the bankruptcy was filed.
Finally, and more importantly, he told the court this, that when a person dies, it's not as if their foreclosure proceedings halt. They just revert to their estate and they continue. And any debts that are owed to the deceased aren't wiped out either. They too revert to the estate of the deceased. So when the Klesnikows were murdered, their son, Sergei Lebed, was appointed executor of their estate, and he continued the foreclosure proceedings against Greg. Greg eventually walked away from the entire ordeal a few months later, giving up his bankruptcy filing because he couldn't afford the attorney fees anymore, and the estate of the Klesnikows did indeed get the part back. Ironically, while he may have been able to negotiate a settlement if they had lived, he certainly couldn't and didn't financially benefit at all from their debts. But that wasn't what the investigators believed, or what the state alleged in the trial against him. Investigators were convinced Greg killed the Klesnikows to be able to keep the trailer park and seize the foreclosure proceedings against him. Now that they had checked off the motive box, they had to address opportunity. Had Victor and Alla met with Greg recently? Were his actions accounted for? Did something set him off? Well, multiple witness statements confirmed that on August 4th, 1998, the day before they were murdered, Victor and Alla made a trip to the Ford Mobile Home Park to conduct an inspection of the trailers sometime between 5 and 6 p.m., presumably to prepare for the upcoming hearing. Along with them was Claude Wright, a handyman who worked for Victor. When they arrived at the trailer park, Keith was there, but Greg wasn't, and they didn't want to conduct the inspection outside of Greg's presence, so they waited about 15 minutes, and then they decided to head back home. In the meantime, Greg had wrapped up his work on Ed Dixon's property in Livington around 4:30 p.m. and was heading back to the mobile home park. When he entered the park, he actually saw Victor leave and assumed he would turn around and come back, but he didn't. According to Claude Wright, later that evening, Greg and Keith showed up at Victor's house around 8 p.m. and Greg asked if Victor wanted to come and conduct the inspection then, except this time Victor wasn't home, so Keith and Greg left. This is, however, according to Claude. Greg's story is a bit different, and the day of the murders, he spent many hours telling it to the authorities.
On the morning of the murders, not long after Victor's sister told investigators that Victor was having a property dispute with a Ford Mobile Home Park owner, TBI agent Bob Krofsik arrived to interview Greg at around 12:30 p.m. The matter had officially been turned over to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, and Agent Krofsik was the lead investigator going forward. The case file includes a lengthy statement given by Greg to Krofsik, in which Greg explained his relationship to Victor and the ongoing foreclosure and bankruptcy proceedings. Greg said the last time he had spoken to Victor was a week prior, when he had come by while Greg was working on a water line in the park. As they discussed the water pipe, Greg told him to consider settling the case so that he could get out of the Chapter 11 proceedings, and Victor indicated he would stop the foreclosure if Greg got caught up in the payments. Greg told Agent Krofsik that a few weeks prior, Victor had offered to buy the place back and indicated that negotiations between the two had been ongoing. Greg then went on to explain his movements the night before. He had worked in the Dixon Project all day, having left for work around 7 a.m. and returning back home shortly after 5:30 p.m. He stayed at the park until about 7:30 p.m. and then headed in his 1990 green Ford Ranger to a bar called Happy Days around 8 o'clock p.m. Unlike Claude, he didn't mention stopping by Victor's with Keith around 8 p.m. Instead, he said he stayed at the bar until around midnight, then went to a convenience store where he bought a 12-pack of beer and returned home finally around 1 a.m. His girlfriend Becky Pollard and his friend and employee Eric Tanner were at the house when he arrived. Like Keith, Eric also lived with Greg and Becky, as did a man named David Anderson. When Greg arrived home that night, neither David nor Keith were there, but Eric was asleep on the couch, and he got up and saw that Greg was in the kitchen, then went back to sleep. After having some food, both Greg and Becky went to bed, and that is where he stayed until the morning. At around 5:30 a.m., he told Agent Krofsik, he woke up to prepare some papers he needed to give his attorney for the hearing that was scheduled in a couple days. He began working on a proposal for Victor, and not long after learned of the fire. When asked if he owned guns, Greg said yes. In fact, he owned seven of them. Two .38 caliber revolvers, a small .25 caliber pistol, a .22 caliber shotgun, a 12-gauge shotgun, a BB pistol, and a pellet gun. Keith also owned a .22 caliber shotgun and sometimes kept it at Greg's house. While he didn't go shooting very frequently, just that morning Greg had shown Keith his .25 automatic, which he kept in a drawer in his office. He had cocked the slide back to make sure it was empty and told Keith he wished it still fired. He really liked the gun. Keith never touched the gun, and Greg put it back in the drawer.
Greg's interview that day lasted for hours. By 3 p.m., as it became clear that he was being considered a suspect in the case, Greg gave his attorney a call and had then given permission to authorities to do a gunshot residue test on his hands, as well as to search his house for weapons and to take two of them for testing, as well as to search his truck using a canine. He also told Krofsek that Keith had been burning trash in the trailer park much of the prior day, cleaning up for the inspection with Victor, and that morning Greg himself had also burned some paper in a burn barrel, a common way of disposing of trash and waste in those parts. He hadn't used any gas or fuel to burn the trash, but noted that the hydraulic crane at the Dixon worksite was leaking fluid all day, though he didn't know if it was leaking gasoline. The thing about a lot of police statements, though, is this. It's often hard to tell why a subject offered certain information. The statements aren't transcripts of the conversation. They're just notes that the police took from the conversation and can leave out significant contextual information. In this case, for example, we can't be sure why Greg mentioned the burn barrels or the fluid from the hydraulic crane. It could be in direct response to questions that Krofsek was asking him, or it could be information that he'd offered up himself. Not knowing which can certainly color the way the statements can be understood, though, because it can make it look like a subject knows more than he or she should about a crime.
Anyhow, getting back to Krofsek's interrogation, it began at 12:30 p.m. and ended at 4:36 p.m., sort of. By that point, Greg was really pretty uncomfortable with Krofsek's aggressiveness. He had already consented to being searched and tested for gunshot residue, but Krofsek was pushing him to admit to knowing something about the crime, which he maintained that he didn't. Greg actually became uncomfortable enough that he stopped the interview and retrieved a tape recorder to record the remainder of the interaction. Krofsek, not to be outdone, whipped out his own recorder. Even though both of them made their own recordings, unfortunately we have neither of the tapes. But we do have a transcript of Krofsek's recording, which begins by noting that the time was now 4:50 p.m. and that Greg was also taping the conversation. Greg then asks, you've been here almost 4 hours just asking me question after question and stuff, and, you know, what are you gonna do? Krofsek acknowledged that it had been about 4 hours and Greg had been cooperative and he was probably tired and made it clear that he believed Greg was involved in the murders. But he tried an old law enforcement tactic, giving Greg a sympathetic opening into admitting his involvement by saying, quote, I do not think you went to Victor's house with any intention of hurting him or doing any harm to him. That maybe something got out of control. Greg wasn't biting, though, and he simply responded with, I'm all talked out, I'm all talked out. Krofsek said, okay, he'd wrap up the interview, but wanted Greg's shoes and socks, quote, freely and voluntarily. Greg agreed, laughing that if he said no, Krofsek would have to get a court order. But he handed them over anyway, unfortunately damning himself with how this evidence was immediately handled. Because right then, the transcript notes a male voice asking, quote, do you just want to add it to the other one? We can put them back together. And Krofsek responds, I can add it on, yes. You go ahead and get me that other thing and I'll just put it together. So instead of bagging each item separately, the agents then stuffed the socks right into the shoes and sealed them up together.
Greg's questioning didn't wrap up with his shoes and socks being bagged. At what he thought was the end of the questioning, he was placed under arrest, but not for the murders of Victor and Alla. There was an outstanding warrant based upon failure to appear on an assault charge in another county stemming from a road rage incident that had taken place on August 1st, the Saturday before the murders. According to the complaint filed against Greg, he was tailgating a couple aggressively as they drove and then followed them into a store parking lot. Once they stopped, Greg allegedly pulled the man from his vehicle and punched him and kicked him, then drove off. Here's how it happened, though, according to Greg.
Yeah, I was coming back from seeing Dad, I guess. I don't remember what it was, but the reason why I was coming through Smithville. But I was coming through Smithville from like McMimble area, and there used to be a passing zone there in front of the they got a huge cemetery as you're coming in, before you come into Smithville, about 6 miles out of town, it's on the left. And there used to be a passing zone there, but they had just repainted the repainted it, so they made it a no passing zone. And I was coming up near that cemetery, they just sit there and just wait until I get up home, and then just pull out in front of me. I mean, almost point blank. And then they're going like 10, 15 mile an hour, and swerving. I figured they was drunk or high or something. And then they would speed up and then slam on their brakes. They'd done that repeatedly. But there was nowhere to pass them. And by the time we got in town where there was a passing zone, there was about 15 cars behind me even. And when it got to where I could pass them, I went ahead and did. And then they sped up and got beside me and started swerving towards me like they were going to hit me. And so I had to pull into the Dollar General store parking lot there. And, the guy said he was going to kick my ass. And so, I got out and met him at his door. And, I hit him a few times, and I hit him as he was standing up out of the car. Hit him on the right side of his head, and then his left side of his head hit the top of the car. He fell back. He started to get up, and I kicked him. He started to get up again, and I grabbed him by his foot. I was trying to keep him down. His shoe come off, and I grabbed his foot again, and his sock came off. And by then, his wife had come up behind me, and so I got the heck out of there.
Regardless of who was provoking who, Greg freely admits that he assaulted the man and then left the scene. This happened in DeKalb County, and Greg figured they may have filed a complaint. So just a few days before the Kalisnikows were murdered, he called around to see if any warrants existed against him, found out what the bond would be, if and when he were arrested, and kept the cash in him, not knowing when he would be picked up. While that warrant was exactly the kind of opportunity the police needed to continue questioning him about the murders, which they did for 5 more hours that night at the station. They didn't just question him, though. They asked him to shave his hands to collect hair in order to determine if any of it was burnt. This single line from a report in the arson records explains why.
Both suspects gave alibis, sometimes contradictory to each other. A TBI agent believes he observed singed hair on the hand of the principal suspect. A closer examination is being planned.
Greg agreed to let them shave his hand, and to this day he maintains they only shaved his left hand, though at trial the state alleged that both of his forearms and hands were shaved. At 10:55 p.m., when Greg finally demanded an attorney and refused to speak any longer, they finally released him. By that time, investigators had already gotten statements from Keith, Keith's girlfriend Kay, and Greg's girlfriend Becky.
Keith, Kay, and Becky essentially all stated the same thing, that Greg had been out for most of the evening, and that Kay and Becky had a bit of a girls' night together, or a crying night, as Kay put it. As she had learned that day of her sister's cancer diagnosis and needed an evening to vent and share and weep with a friend. Kay and Becky picked up groceries and returned to Kay's trailer, cooked some food, and were there eating when Keith showed up around 8 p.m. Which fits Greg's timeline because that's around the time that Greg said he left the trailer park for his night out. Keith ended up hanging out with Kay and Becky for the rest of the night, drinking and watching TV, and then he and Kay dropped Becky off at her house around 11 p.m. Neither he nor Kay saw Greg again until the morning of the 5th, when he went over to his house and told him about the fire at the Kalisnik house. In his police statement, Keith confirmed what Greg said about showing him a gun in the office drawer that morning, and that he hadn't touched it. He also confirmed that both he and Greg had been burning trash and papers over the past couple days. Becky wasn't alone when she was dropped back off at the house that night, though. Eric Tanner was home too, and according to their police statements, both Becky and Eric Tanner had seen Greg back at the house by 1 a.m. that night. Eric had gone back to sleep after seeing Greg, but Becky had stayed up with him as he ate, and then they went to bed together soon after. Well, investigators asked Becky, could Greg have gotten back up and left again without her knowing? That's unlikely, she said. They had a waterbed, and she would have been woken up if he'd moved. Plus, when she woke up in the morning, he was home in bed with her. The
These witness statements seemed to line up pretty well for Greg, and yet he had a bit of a problem. Because while it was true that he was out the night before, he wasn't exactly being honest with Krofcik about where he was and what he was doing. Greg and Becky had what could be understood in contemporary terms, an open relationship. While they lived together and apparently loved each other, and even had become pregnant earlier but lost a child, they had an understanding that they could see other people, and that is precisely what Greg was doing the night before the murders. A woman that he knew from the National Guard happened to be in town and called him up to meet him. So he did.
Actually, no, I met her at the General Lee truck stop, and then we drove from there to the Happy Days Bar in her vehicle. Stayed there for a while, had a few drinks, then we went back to and rented a motel there. So whatever that is there, General Lee truck stop, there's a motel there.
Okay.
Stayed there until about 12:30 maybe. That's when I went home, and on the way home, before I stopped at the store, Becky called me on the cell phone, and I told her I was coming home.
That call, by the way, exists in the phone records, coming in at 12:28 a.m. But getting back to what Greg was up to that night, to be completely honest, it elicited some strong mixed feelings when I learned this. Greg didn't disclose that he was with this woman to the authorities in his initial police interview, but later he did tell his own defense attorneys and defense investigator that he was with her. And they interviewed that woman numerous times as they prepared for trial. But why did he hide it from the police initially, though? I figured it was so his girlfriend Becky wouldn't find out. But according to Greg, Becky already knew because he told her as soon as he got home that night. Now, I did have a hard time believing that he would do that, but then I came across a police interview of Keith's girlfriend Kay, where she told Krofcik that Keith wasn't too thrilled with Becky and Kay hanging out that night alone. Why is that? Krofcik asked. Quote, because she made it very obvious that she wanted to go to bed with me, Kay responded, and went on to explain that Becky had very clearly propositioned her in the past. Apparently, Becky's sexual involvement with others, both men and women, was pretty common knowledge in their circle. So, while it seems that Becky and Greg did indeed have an open relationship, Greg didn't think it was any of Krofcik's business what he was specifically up to the night before, and that was a very bad call on his part, because hiding that tryst from authorities only hurt Greg. Instead of telling the truth, he told Agent Krofcik that he was at the bar the entire night, but when investigators went to check at the bar, no one remembered seeing Greg because he had actually only been there briefly. And as for the mini-mart where he said he got the beer, here's what the store clerk said, who was interviewed about 24 hours after Greg said that he had been there.
I came on duty at 11 p.m. on Tuesday, August 4th, 1998, and worked until 7:20 a.m. on Wednesday morning, on August 5th, 1998. I remember any strangers that come in because most of the customers on the third shift are regular customers. I don't remember a male, white stranger that night, and I have never seen the two people that I was shown photos of. I would have remembered it if they'd been there that night.
These apparent lies, coupled with what they saw as a clear motive, not only increased the investigator's suspicion, it doomed Greg Lance to be the only target of the investigation. A report written by Philip Gentry of the Fire Marshal's office the day after Greg's interrogation states, quote, two suspects have been identified and the investigation is continuing. The principal suspect, believed to be the shooter, had purchased a trailer park from the victims for $650,000. A lawsuit between the suspect is pending, and the victim was experiencing a cash flow problem. Tension between the two was reportedly escalating. Both suspects gave alibis, sometimes contradictory to each other. It's clear that Greg had become the principal suspect because he had, according to the police, the greatest motive to kill the Klesnikows, and his whereabouts weren't accounted for. Now, initially, Keith was also a suspect, maybe because he also had a stake in the trailer park. Or maybe because when the police asked other trailer park tenants who had the loudest car in the park, they were told it was Keith's girlfriend, Kay, who had a four-door, small, brownish-golden sedan. Remember in the end of last episode, the search warrant Krofcik had taken out for a car that he personally observed, matching the description of the car leaving the crime scene? Yeah, that was Kay's car. Eventually, though, Keith would cease becoming a suspect and the investigation would focus on Greg alone. But in order to make it all fit, the state had to patch together a narrative that defied logic and logistics in order to get their man. Next time on Undisclosed. Greg Lance has been in prison since 1999. If you'd like to drop him a note of support or a card or anything to let him know that you're following his story and thinking about him, address your letters to Gregory Paul Lance, ID 003-25463. The Bledsoe County Correctional Complex, BLEDSOE, Bledsoe County Correctional Complex, located at 1045 Horsehead Road in Pikeville, Tennessee, zip code 37367. Now, lots of thank yous. A big thank you to all of our sponsors who helped make this episode, this series, and really all of our work possible. We could not continue to investigate wrongful convictions and try to help those wrongfully convicted if we didn't have our sponsors. So if you want to support our work, if you want to support the folks that we are trying to help in our series, please support our sponsors. They make the production possible. Thank you to our Wizard of Oz, who keeps everything running like clockwork behind the scenes, executive producer Mithil Thelhan. Thank you to our audio producer extraordinaire, Rebecca Lavoie, host of one of my favorite podcasts, Crime Writers On. Thank you, Baluki, for our logo, Patrick Cortez for our theme song. Thank you to Linda Bozeman and the family of Greg Lance for working with us in order for us to do an investigation into this case. And a huge thank you to my legal intern for this entire series, Asa Qureshi, who has just put in days and days and weeks of going through documents and organizing things and just making my life easier. And finally, thank you all of our listeners for staying with us case after case, year after year. Follow us on social media. We're on Twitter at the handle at @undisclosedpod. And remember to tweet us your questions for the undisclosed addendum using the hashtag UDaddendum. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, and our website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com.